The following podcast is rated P for puns and childish corporate bickering.
Could have said bad puns there, but we'll leave it.
You're welcome. Welcome to Rated P. I'm Yates.
I am Brighton. We have a great episode for you today because we are running through the other half of our heist movie bracket. Should be a great time with two number one seeds back in action and a slew of other great heist movies. But before we get started on that glorious expedition, holy smokes, do we have some news to cover.
Oh boy, don't we. Yeah.
We got an absolute bombshell this week in terms of fallout from Trolls World Tour, which is a phrase I never thought that I would say.
But somehow seems fitting in a way.
It does.
Yeah. Brighton, our first piece of news involves the theater industry, and people are big mad about some stuff. And they are not handling it very well, which I think makes this a perfect time to debut a brand new segment.
Petty alarm, petty alarm, petty alarm.
Anyway, basically what happened is due to the commercial success of Trolls World Tour, which Brighton and I have talked about a fair bit, both leading up to and in the aftermath of the release of that film, as one may venture to call it. Basically, it did really well. It went straight to home video and did really, really well. Then Universal was like, hey, that did really well. We shouldn't only do this during a pandemic. We should do this all the time. Basically saying that all their new releases, they plan to release straight to video on demand or, you know, rental or whatever, and also in theaters. And let me tell you, Brighton, the theaters did not like that one bit.
Oh, I can't imagine that they did. What did they have to say?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Adam Aron... A-D-A-M-A-R-O-N. Sounds like a supervillain name, if I'm being perfectly honest. the CEO and president of AMC Entertainment, owner of over 1,000 theaters worldwide, which he will not let you forget, came out and had some choice words for Donna, the CEO and president of Universal. Here are some of the things that he said in his... longly worded passive-aggressive letter. Amidst a global pandemic as a backdrop, I wish we were spared from also having to address a different issue that arises from Universal, capitalize Universal, actions currently underway. He then goes on to say, when a movie is only in theaters, consumers perceive it to be higher quality entertainment. Countless filmmakers and moviegoers believe that their creative works are best enjoyed by consumers on the big screen. A valid point. This is these couple sentences are the meat of the letter and what he's really getting at. Aron says, in today's Wall Street Journal, today being whatever day he wrote this letter, Jeff Shell, a Universal higher-up, presumably, is quoted as saying that the result for Trolls World Tour have exceeded our expectations and demonstrated the viability of PVOD, which I assume means paid video on demand. As soon as theaters reopen, we expect to release movies on both formats. This radical change by Universal to the business model that currently exists between our two companies represents nothing but downside for us and is categorically unacceptable to AMC Entertainment, the world's largest collection of movie theaters. Going forward, AMC will not license any Universal movies in any of our 1,000 theaters globally on these terms.
Boom.
He goes into more things, and it is truly a masterclass of passive aggression that I highly recommend you all go read. But yeah, I mean, basically, he's woof. He went for it.
He's petty.
Oh, he's petty.
Yeah, and shortly after that letter came out, Regal Theaters also voiced their support of AMC, saying that they would not show Universal movies in their theater chain either. It's gotten ugly pretty quickly on that front. And I gotta say, yeah, it's a losing battle for theaters. I think that this is it. I'm going to take kind of a cynical stance here. I think this is the signification of the end here for theaters. It's just, there's no going back. You know, we had been kind of bumping up against this point for a while due to streaming services and, you know, the popularity and the accessibility of movies beyond theater formats. And the COVID-19 pandemic has forced the hand of studios to do this. And Trolls World Tour, while it's not the pioneer that anybody expected or wanted, it was successful. It really was. Not as successful as the first movie in theaters. And obviously, it being a sequel and a kids movie makes it have certain levels of success that other movies won't see on VOD. But it really did break down the wall in terms of this. And while I don't think that this means like theaters won't come back by the time that the pandemic ends, I do think that from here on out, it's, you know, the writing is on the wall in some form.
Now, I'm not sure I'm going to go quite that far. I don't necessarily think that is true.
Why not, for
a couple reasons. One, I think a lot of people really enjoy the experience of going out and going to the theaters, and I think that there will be a place for that for a while. You know, I also think Trolls World Tour was $20 to rent for like 48 hours, and people are, you know, it's, if you're, you know, going on a date and want to see a movie, it's not necessarily going to be economical for two people to spend that money rather than go to a theater. Now, that's not all the time. I spent $15 on a movie ticket before. But, you know, there is certainly some pricing that would need to be worked out there, I think, to really seal the deal in the way that you're saying it will. Now, I think that in the long term, it's kind of inevitable, and we've known that for a while. We've kind of felt that, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, theaters won't be as much of a deal. I could certainly see that moving up to, like, you know, 7 to 10 years down the road. But, I mean, I think there will always be a place for, you know, the movie theater in American culture, but certainly not as much as it is right now. And certainly not as much as it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago when that was, you know, much more so that was your only option to see a movie.
But why is the theater a part of American culture? Yes, it's because of the experience that people have, but it's also because that's how studios make money. That's how studios would make money. And so I imagine that this new format, if more studios join Universal in releasing some movies on VOD, we need to preface it by this. This whole kind of battle is over something called windowing. Right now, movie theaters and studios have agreements that if a movie is playing in theaters, it cannot be widely accessible to the public in any other format for 60 days. That is the window. And so what Universal is saying is, with this new VOD option, is that window would be much shorter, or it would be concurrent with when it's in theaters. And theaters obviously don't want that. They want the exclusivity of people coming to see it only there. And so I think this step is changing the windowing no matter what. Like, that is not, there's no going back from that. Windowing is going to be changed by the time we get out of this pandemic, I think. I agree that the theater experience and all that stuff will not change for blockbusters, but I could very much easily see small budget movies or indie films, stuff like that, where you don't get as much of a draw to go out to theaters. The point of the movie isn't necessarily to make a ton of money. I could easily see those being put on VOD, and then it slowly becomes the point where the only movies that are in theaters are big blockbusters, and then it will become financially viable for studios to just not have to worry about theaters as the middleman for those.
That's interesting that you bring up that point about, you know, indie films and things like that, because one of the things that I forgot to mention earlier is I feel like, you know, like art house cinemas, you know, like small time theaters that show limited run movies and things like that. I feel like those are the types of theaters that would survive all this, but it seems like you're suggesting that maybe not. Maybe that, you know, if those movies become much more widely accessible, you know, I mean, there are certain movies that like just came out that I have trouble finding to even rent or and stuff, but that may be playing in, you know, a specific theater near me that I know plays those kind of movies. Do you think that even that type of theater would become obsolete?
No, I think that's a good point. I do think that they would still exist, but honestly, that might be what all theaters move to. I'm talking in like big theater chains, like going and seeing a movie with like 250 other people, I think is just not going to be a thing anymore. And it's not because people don't want to. I really do think it's going to be because studios can find that they can make money otherwise. And I'm not saying that this is an immediate thing, but I do think that the changing of the windowing makes a huge, huge difference. And this is just a shot across the bow. Like, AMC and Regal are really just doing this because they've been threatened for the last decade and should be scared. Like, they should be scared. This is all that they can do. This is the only hill that they have to die on. And I'm sure Universal is eventually going to either walk back those comments. They've already tried, but it's very half-hearted. And they're going to work something out. But, like, the biggest negotiating chip that theaters have, which is, oh, not that many people would pay to see these movies, is kind of off the table. And we will get in the coming months more examples that studios will be able to pull from. Just this week, it was announced that the Judd Apatow comedy King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson, is also going to be going straight to VOD. We'll be able to get more examples of movies like those, which aren't necessarily big blockbusters or tent poles or things that have previous material to pull from and get people interested in, and we'll be able to gauge how those films do. But I really do believe that, I mean, this is the turning point. This is what theaters have been scared about happening for the last few years, and the pandemic has really, as you said, shortened the timeline of their existence and relevance. And it's sad. I don't necessarily want it, but I really don't see how this doesn't signify how everything is going to change from here on out.
I think that, you know, there are certainly a couple things that could happen in the coming days. I mean, this is like probably the most developing story we have ever reported on. In Googling, like kind of in like trying to find some information before this episode, I just saw new stuff on the page saying that Regal is walking back its statement some. Which was not there like 20 minutes ago. I think that every player here could be making empty threats, or at least threats that will end up being empty. I'm assuming that none of them are for the time being. But I mean, that's all just to say we'll have to wait and see. But there was other pretty big news related to this week, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. And that would be the Academy Awards coming out with some rule changes. And it's directly tied to the pandemic and the accessibility of movies. For the longest time, the Academy Awards have required a movie to play at least one day in Los Angeles in a movie theater. And the Academy has, for now, temporarily waived that rule. They approved their board of governors approved rule changes for this upcoming ceremony, waiving the requirement that movies must play in theaters, which means that streaming films, exclusively streaming films, will be eligible for Academy Awards in February. They also made a change where they combined the sound mixing and sound editing awards into one sound category, which we discussed a little bit in our Oscar episodes in the past, not a ton. That's a shame, but we have too much to discuss today to really get into it.
Let me just say, if they had done that this year, my picks would have been a lot better.
Yeah, that's all I have to say about. Yes, yeah, since you had the right ones flipped. So it's unclear whether this is going to stand forever, and I don't think that the Academy, knowing them and knowing their stance on streaming movies, will
or change
keep this
of
rule.
Any kind.
Right, we'll keep this rule, but essentially they are saying that the film must be made available on the secure Academy Screening Room member-only streaming site within 60 days of the film's streaming or VOD release, and that it must meet all other eligibility requirements. But this completely opens the door for movies that might be award contenders if this pandemic continues to go ahead and get put out now instead of having to try and cram themselves into a potentially crowded slate come fall and winter. But it also, as you said, signifies a big change that the Academy has not been willing to make otherwise. And I don't know if it's necessarily the thawing of a big old glacier in terms of how they do things, but it's big news.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it'll be really interesting to see, you know, I mean, with both of these stories and just with movies as a whole, and I mean, the world as a whole, really, but, you know, how this pandemic will kind of force the hand of various decision makers and players. And I'm sure that this is only the beginning of some of those changes. And I'm interested and excited to see what some of the others will be.
Well, as you said, it's certainly going to be a developing story for weeks and months, if not years, in terms of how the theaters things and potentially the Oscars will shake down. So for now, let's go ahead and move into our heist movie bracket discussion and tackle the other two quadrants.
Right, the rumors are true. We are back on our heist grind, starting off today with the West Region. So, number one seed versus the number eight seed. Two pretty good movies.
This is more of a heavyweight fight than more people would think. Featuring one of an absolute rated P darling.
That's a word you could use for it, I guess.
that would be the 8-seed Den of Thieves. Den of Thieves, starring Gerard Butler, Pablo Schreiber, 50 Cent, and O'Shea Jackson Jr., a.k.a. Lil' Cube.
You know his name!
Do you not?
No! I just call him Lil Cube. Why would I need to call him anything else? And you had to think about it. I saw you have to think about it.
I did have to think about it. I couldn't remember if he's O'Shea Jackson or O'Shea Jackson Jr. And I could be totally wrong, and he might be O'Shea Jackson.
Now, Brian and I do love Den of Thieves. It's true. And it is a shame that it has to be an 8 seed going up against another movie that I really, really love, Quentin Tarantino's feature debut, Reservoir Dogs. This is the third feature debut of a widely acclaimed director that we have had in this bracket. So if you want to make it in Hollywood, first movie, make it a heist movie.
Yeah, that's a fine rule. Now, as you said, it's a tough matchup, but when you break down, as we did in the previous one, the jobs, the crew, and the films themselves, it's a pretty interesting matchup. So when you look at the job of Den of Thieves, the main heist that they pull is robbing the U.S. Federal Reserve. They also pull off a successful heist of an armored truck. So when looking at that heist, yeah, the risk is high. The degree of difficulty is extremely high.
The take is also pretty high.
The take is also extremely high.
When you compare that to Reservoir Dogs, wherein you don't really see the heist, like, I think it's a bank, and whatever it is a colossal freaking failure. I think it's safe to say that Den of Thieves takes the job. Or they, one could say, get the job done.
Nice.
Thank you.
Now, I've not seen Reservoir Dogs, so I cannot speak to the crew. I will say that the crew in Den of Thieves, everybody has a role. Some people are more essential than others. You're only invested in, like, the three people that I named, which is Pablo Schreiber, Lil Cube, and 50 Cent. And obviously you're invested in Big Nick, but Big Nick is not a good guy.
However, Big Nick also has his own crew of very forgettable people.
It's true. So you have a double crew here, but you know, acting is not the point of this movie. And so so you know, their performances are fine. They're, you know, they do a good job on the action scenes.
Are fine, except for Gerard Butler, whose performance is abysmal.
Yes.
It's so bad.
Yes. But so memorable.
Yes, very
because
true.
Because he throws a donut in the hot zone.
Good point. When you compare that to Reservoir Dogs, you have a crew, you know, because you never really see the heist, you don't really get defined roles, you don't even really get to know many of them super well. But it is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly acted. Way more so than Den of Thieves is. So that one's a little bit of a toss-up, but I think that in terms of a heist movie crew, Den of Thieves has got to take the cake. You have much more a sense of a team. You get to know them a lot better, and you get to know how they work together, why they work together, and things like that, whereas you don't really get that quite as much in Reservoir Dogs. And that's really, like, the key to this movie. Reservoir Dogs is a heist movie, but kind of it is victim of the way that we are scoring these matchups, because it definitely does kind of bend the parameters of a heist movie to the point that it is such an extreme twist on a classic heist movie that it is almost unrecognizable as a heist movie.
Right, and as you said, going by parameters, if we were going purely by quality of film, I have no doubt in my mind that Reservoir Dogs would have taken this.
It would
no
blow
problem.
It out of the water. Like, it wouldn't
Den of Thieves
even,
is
yeah.
not very good, as we mentioned. Acting is optional. Often, you know, kind of good dialogue is optional.
Den of Thieves could the tagline could have been acting optional, heist necessary, which for this bracket.
That's all you need.
It's good. Good enough.
So we have our first one seed going down as Den of Thieves wins that matchup against Reservoir Dogs in stunning fashion, I think is fair to say. Next up, it's another pretty heavyweight battle. This is a 4-5 matchup, so a little more even here. Two very good movies as well. And you've got The Town in the 4-seed spot going up against Snatch in the 5-seed.
You cannot convince me that The Town should lose this matchup.
I'm not even going to argue. I mean, we can knock this one out pretty quickly. You want to run through The Town?
I got it. Let's see. The Job, they're robbing Fenway Park. Fenway Park. Boston Red Sox? Heard of them? Yeah, Fenway Park.
And not just a normal day at Fenway Park. After a Yankees series.
Yeah. So, I mean, come on. Boston. Red Sox, Yankees, come on. Charlestown, come on. Yeah, I mean, and you also have a couple of different heists throughout the movie, pretty much all of which are successful. The final big heist is ultimately successful. So, I mean, for The Job, this one gets like 9 out of 10, 9.5 out of 10. In terms of the crew, you got Ben Affleck, who you come to care about an incredible amount.
Dougie.
You have Jim, played by Jeremy Renner, who is unhinged.
Does a phenomenal job.
Yo, he kills it. He does a great job. You know, he's telling the unhinged teammate, and you know, you care about him too. You get the sense that like he's had a lot of hurt and a lot of hardship in his life. So you kind of really get to care about those two and are really invested in their success, even though you can kind of sense the inherent tragedy that is incoming. And in the film, I mean, it's really good. Like it's a good movie. I will say it's kind of derivative of, like, Heat. I think I watched Heat for the first time, like, 2 days after I watched this one. And I was like, oh, Heat is the blueprint. I get it. But Heat's a good heist movie.
It is. And, I'm very excited to talk about Heat later this episode.
Yeah, and so is The Town.
Yeah, Snatch is, we're going to be talking about The Town more, I think. I mean, it wins this matchup, so let's discuss it a little bit more in that. So I'm going to give Snatch some love, because I watched this one, I had never seen it before, and was really impressed by it. It's not really a heist movie. I would describe it more as, like, a robbery or a heist gone wrong. But let me just give you the setup here, Yates. So the job is, there are two. The first one is in the very beginning. It is literally the title sequence, essentially, when a character named Frankie Four Fingers, played by Benicio del Toro, steals an 86-carat diamond in Antwerp from a Jewish diamond collecting place. And they sneak in with disguises and hold it up, and then they get it. And then the second job is stealing the diamond from Frankie, a Russian guy named Boris, who knows that Frankie has the diamond in a suitcase handcuffed to him, wants to steal it. So he tells Frankie to place a bet for him at a boxing match, and then he hires a pair of small-time crooks to then rob Frankie while at the bookies. That goes horribly wrong, and then it sets off a long chain of events of many different storylines in Snatch that then come together. It's really fun. But as I said, not particularly a heist movie. The heist isn't really the point. It's everything that's on the periphery that's going on and happening around the diamond as people are trying to get the diamond. It's a great film. Really fun and really stylish. Cool action sequences. Incredibly stacked cast. But in this matchup, it's not going any further.
Well, fair enough. And really, it drew quite the unlucky draw. Going up against
an absolute buzzsaw.
Oh, an absolute buzzsaw. I mean, not only is it a great heist movie, it's a great Boston movie. Moving on to our 3-6 matchup. As a reminder, the sixth seed here was the winner of the playing game between Bottle Rocket and Ant-Man. So that would be Ant-Man. So we have Thief from 1983 going up against Ant-Man.
So I think, like, the last matchup, that this one is pretty clear-cut too, right? We talked about Ant-Man a little bit last episode, but, you know, the heist in Ant-Man is not exactly the point. It's Scott Lang breaking into Hank Pym's house and into a safe to steal the Ant-Man suit. It kind of is the instigator for what happens in the movie, but it's not really the point. The crew isn't great because it's really just Scott Lang and the other people are not doing much. And then, you know, it's an average film. So tell me a little bit about Thief, and does it have enough to take the win here?
Thief absolutely does. And the reason that it does is because it has everything. It kind of like how I said about Reservoir Dogs. It is, you know, it is such a twist on the heist movie genre that it loses a lot of heistiness kind of in the margins. Thief is just enough of a twist that it keeps a lot of the heistiness to still keep it as a great heist movie. It is not, you know, it centers around the heists without being about the heists. And that is where it does a really good job. The crew in this movie, there isn't really one. It really just focuses around James Caan and kind of his involvement with different people, different crews, and different heists throughout the movie. But, I mean, you know, like I said, it focuses on James Caan, and, like, I cried. I openly cried, like, in the second act of this movie. That doesn't happen, and it sure as hell doesn't happen with heist movies. You really get to care about the character of James Caan and kind of his family that a lot of this movie centers around. And the film is just really, really good. It does a great job of taking the, you know, he has to do this one last job to protect his family thing. It's showing you, it balances its time perfectly between him as a thief and him as a family man so that you really understand how the two are interconnected. I think this was something I said about the score, was it was kind of like he has to do his one last job to provide for his wife, but you never get to know his wife. You never get to like see their relationship, see why that's important to him. It's just kind of like you meet her at the beginning and he's like, I'll take care of you, babe. And then you see her at the end and he's like, ah, I took care of you, babe. Whereas like this, you get a lot of really intense relationship drama. And you see that, I mean, their lives really depend on this in a lot of ways. And that is where kind of what leads to the climax of the movie and makes the heists much more intense, much more stressful. And so, I mean, you know, you said the crew in Ant-Man wasn't that good. You could make an argument the crew in here isn't that good because it's just James Caan, but you care about him. It's a hell of a good movie, and he pulls off some pretty exciting jobs. So I got to say, I think that's a clean sweep for Thief.
You've convinced me. I'm down for that. So it will be facing the winner of the 2-7 matchup, and that is The Sting versus Ronin.
Let me give you the brief rundown on Ronin so that you guys can just see why The Sting wins. Ronin is named after the idea of a freelance samurai whose master was killed. And you basically have, like, I want to say six freelance thieves who are hired by the Irish government to steal a briefcase so they don't know what's in. They go, they steal the briefcase, they do some, like, lead up. Robert De Niro's the lead. He kind of has a thing with the girl that hired them, and that's confusing. But they go to steal the briefcase, and then someone on their team betrayed them. It's a manhunt movie. They're trying to give it to the Russians. They're trying to double-cross the Irish. It's a whole thing. I don't even remember how it ends. And the heist is, like, halfway through, and then there's no more heisting. Ice skater gets murdered for no reason. And right? Random, right? That's what I thought when watching the movie. And it just, the heist just kind of happens, and then it's over. So, Now, The Sting, on the other hand, Robert Redford, Paul Newman. All right, let's move on.
Well, I mean, we got to run through the job a little bit here for The Sting. It is largely set around a very, very elaborate scheme to get a crime boss out of a fair amount of money and to get revenge for a murdered friend. And essentially, Robert Redford and Paul Newman set up an elaborate scheme where it's a bookie taking bets out of a racehorse, and they scheme the crime boss to place a bet and then eventually get arrested at this place after, while still being able to keep like the $500,000 that was bet. And yeah, it's well done across the board. Between Robert Redford and Newman, they're mostly the crew, but the surrounding people are pretty good too. But they're incredible. We already know about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. They're very good in this movie too. It's a great time. And so, yeah, it sounds like a pretty easy dub for The Sting.
And let me just say one thing in defense of Ronin. If you just want to sit down and watch a movie from 1998 about France that's somewhat exciting, Ronin is the perfect movie for you. It did more to make me want to travel to France than make me care about the heist. So,
okay.
That's all I got.
Not enough to win here. All right, so the second round matchup in the West Quadrant. Now we have number 8, Den of Thieves, going up against number 4, The Town. And this is an absolute beat-down, drag-em-out, no-holds-barred fight
between
two movies.
Literally, this is like two people playing like FIFA with the exact same teams, but one of the people playing is just way better than the other. Like, the movies are super similar. The Town just doesn't suck.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is the big difference here, right? Like, not only is it told in a more interesting way where, you know, there's some family drama that could be cut out of The Town, but there's a lot of family drama that could be cut out of Den of Thieves. The dialogue is way better. Den of Thieves is just like, you know, it's supposed to be L.A., but it feels like Atlanta, I think. or maybe it's the other way around. I don't even remember. Whereas, I feel like you know, the town is very much,
honestly.
Yeah, whereas the town is very much in Charlestown, and does a great job of just placing you there and telling you kind of the history and the general vibe.
The town makes you care like so much more than Den of Thieves ever does. And that's
like we care about Den of Thieves because we made it through. And we're like, yo, that is a ridiculous movie. whereas the town is like, yeah, some ridiculous stuff happens, but the story that is being told is not ridiculous.
For a little bit of background on Brighton's and Mine Den of Thieves watching experience, just before we bid it farewell for the remainder of this bracket, Brighton was like, hey, there's this movie, Den of Thieves. I've heard like great things about it. Which is true. I had also heard great things about it. I'm not making a dig at Brighton here. I shared that assessment. And it's on HBO. We should watch it.
Great things as in, like, it's a diamond in the rough. Like, it's it's like a hidden gem.
Yeah. About halfway through the movie, one of us had, I don't know if we had to, like, use the bathroom or get a drink refill or whatever. We paused the movie. Brighton just turns to me and says, I am so sorry, and walks out of the room.
yeah.
But
we made it through.
And there are some real gems in that movie. However, there is a real gem in the town.
Yeah, I think it's I think yes. Okay, fine. I will acknowledge the pun.
Yeah.
Going by how we're scoring it, you could even say that if you just push both Job and Crew, if you say they're tied there, I mean, film is where it takes.
Well,
it.
But like, I think you could push Job, but Town's got to take Crew. I mean, but between Doug and Jim, you care so much more about them and their motivations, and just get a much more fleshed out character development there. That it takes two out of three. And Den of Thieves probably takes Job because it's the Federal Reserve. And that whole scene is pretty well done. But au revoir to Den of Thieves.
You will be missed. All right, so that leads us to the 2-3 matchup here, The Sting versus Thief. Now, as I said, I've not seen Thief. So what are you thinking here, Yates? What are you leaning?
I feel like Thief should win. But then going category by category, Sting takes movie. And I think Sting also takes Crew, even though the Job in Thief is way better, and Thief is a marginally worse movie.
Okay.
So I guess Sting takes it. I don't know. It's really close. For me, it's really close. But I think that if you look at it piece by piece, Sting takes it.
I'm fine with that. I'm excited to revisit Sting as we reach the Elite Eight here so we can really parse out the differences here, because I remember it being great, and I think it's very much one of the OG heist movies that kind of sets up the whole, you know, it lays the groundwork for what the Steven Soderbergh Ocean's 11 does and all that kind of stuff.
And, I mean, you know, it's definitely not super conventional. Like, they're not robbing a ton of money from a place. It's a little bit more of a con job, but it does still have a lot of heist elements to it. And I mean, it, you know, you should go watch Thief. Everyone listening to this should go watch Thief. Thief is a movie I had never heard anything about until I went and watched it so we could do this bracket. And I was pretty blown away by it. It is really, really, really good. Hugely surprising. Highly recommend if you get the chance.
So The Sting and The Town punch their tickets to the Elite Eight in the West Quadrant. Should be a pretty fun matchup next week. But before we even worry about that any further, we've got to go to the final quadrant, the North Quadrant, where we have the number one overall seed, which is Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino, taking on Ocean's 8 as the 8 seed. That was the victor of the playing game against the 1960 version of Ocean's 11. Yates, we had this happen earlier today.
No way.
I think we're going to see it happen again.
No way. UMBC, who is she?
If you run through the categories for Dog Day Afternoon. The job that Al Pacino's character tries to pull with one other guy does not go very well. They're trying to rob a bank in New York. They do not do any sort of casing ahead of time to learn when amounts of money will be in the bank, because they try and rob it and it's only like just more than $1,000 barely. It is not even remotely successful. The movie quickly turns into a hostage movie instead of a heist movie. And it ultimately fails. Like, it does not go very well. The crew in this one, compared to Ocean's 8, you only have two guys, so they're very important to each other, but you're only really invested in one, and one of them is really only is doing all the work. The other one is really just holding up the hostages.
I mean, yeah, the other one doesn't it really have that many lines. I think his name is, what, Sal or something? It really, all that you get to know about his character is that he doesn't want people to think he's gay, which really doesn't help you sympathize with him, especially in today's day and age. Yeah, I mean, it's really like a one-man show across the board.
And it's great performances, but, you know, that's not enough to necessarily have it take the crew section. And it's a really good film. I think between the two, Dog Day Afternoon wins the film category, but Ocean's 8 is much more of a heist movie. I mean, the job in Ocean's 8, robbing diamonds from the Met Gala, is awesome.
Oh, and it's super well done. It's exciting to see how they work it all out and how they kind of figure it out to make it all work. And you just never really get anything like that with Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, and then the crew is great too. I mean, a fantastic slate of actresses. And everybody's role is really essential. Everybody has a specific job to do, and they all crush it. It's an extremely successful heist. And so even though I would say Dog Day Afternoon takes that one, we have another 8 seed upsetting a 1 seed here with Ocean's 8 winning the matchup.
And speaking of Ocean's 8 and Ocean's movies, the moment you've all been waiting for, our 4 seed in this region is the Steven Soderbergh Ocean's 11, going up against the 5 seed, Spike Lee's Inside Man.
Real quick, we did an objective method of seeding these, but it still blows my mind that this Ocean's 11 movie is a 4 seed. How on earth, critically and audience score-wise, is it a 4 seed here?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, looking at all the 3 seeds, really the only one I really question is, it's below Bonnie and Clyde? Like,
yeah,
come on.
There's something wrong. This is definitely one of those where if we were doing it purely off of the strength of it being a high school movie.
Oh, 1 seed for
easy,
sure.
Easy number 1 seed. Yeah. And so it's a pretty interesting matchup here, and it's a movie that many people know, but do you want to go ahead and run through the job and whatnot for this film?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Danny Ocean, played by George Clooney, gets together 10 others, and then 11 including him, to rob, is it the Bellagio, I think? Yeah, the Bellagio in Las Vegas.
Three casinos in one night, I thought.
Oh, is it 3 different ones? I thought it was just one to get back at the owner. Or does he own all 3 of them?
I think they rob a vault that has all 3. But I could be wrong. Either way, it's like $150 million.
It's a lot of money. That they take from Andy Garcia, which they take because Andy Garcia is not being very kind to Danny Ocean's wife. That's the gist of it. And it's great. It's really great.
I mean, it's a super elaborate job. Everybody is really successful. As you said, George Clooney starring, but the rest of the crew has just A-lister after A-lister.
Yeah.
Matt Damon in a supporting role. I mean, it is unbelievable.
Don Cheadle is like a footnote in this movie.
Yeah, Don Cheadle not doing a very good performance,
yeah,
admittedly.
Well, but also,
a horrible accent.
To have Don Cheadle as a footnote.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film, and it's incredibly well executed. Now, Inside Man, I do think, gives it a bit of a run for its money. It's a very, very good heist movie. Let me run you down this one, Yates. So, Spike Lee movie is a crew of 5 people who rob a bank, but they are specifically robbing it for a safe deposit box full of French diamonds and Nazi documents. You do not know this until the end of the movie that that is what they are going for. It has very high importance, and it buys them a lot of leverage, and ultimately kind of plays a role in how they get out. Obviously, robbing a bank, that is a pretty high difficulty, but there's no special security here, and what makes it so spectacular is their planning is meticulous. So all obstacles they face in this movie are dispatched very quickly, and it is extremely successful. Everybody gets away scot-free. It's a brilliant plan. Now, you are following the detective who is trying to, you know, get this bank heist stopped. And so you're not all that invested in the crew, and you're supposed to be kind of guessing who it is who's exactly in the crew besides the mastermind of the plan, who is played by Clive Owen and who has an opening narration that's pretty cool. And it's really well done. It's got really cool dialogue. Denzel Washington delivers a great performance. A pretty unique heist that has a lot of morals behind it too, and a clever twist at the end, which is exactly what you want for a heist movie, and pretty similar to what happens in Ocean's 11 too. I think where it falters is just that, you know, the heist is central, but the audience isn't necessarily rooting for the people who are pulling off the heist, whereas in Ocean's 11, they are. And I think that, you know, even though the take is higher for Inside Man, I think it's fair to say that the job is a higher degree of difficulty in terms of security and people actively looking for them in Ocean's 11. And so Ocean's 11 takes job. It narrowly edges it out in terms of film, in terms of the role that the heist plays. So that's 2 out of 3, but that's not even mentioning the crew and the incredibly stacked cast that Ocean's 11 has compared to Inside Man. But it's a good one. That's a fun 4-5 matchup.
Sounds like Inside Man goes in the same category as Thief for ones that didn't make it but are definitely, definitely, definitely worth watching.
Yes.
All right. Up next, we have the one that we mentioned earlier as The Blueprint. We have Heat going up against Bill Murray's directorial debut. Another directorial debut, not necessarily one that I'd say is like a Hollywood juggernaut. But the number 6 seed, Quick Change.
Yeah, and it's an interesting inclusion in this, I've got to say. So let's go kind of one by one on this, because it's an interesting matchup for Heat. I don't think it gives it a run for its money in terms of it being a true heist movie, but through the categories, I think it's a closer matchup than one would think. So in Quick Change, the heist is $1 million. They're stealing it from a bank in downtown New York, and they have a clean escape to the airport for a flight to Fiji. The degree of difficulty is relatively high. I would say in comparison to other heists in this movie, it's about middle of the road. It's very much like Dog Day Afternoon, but extremely successful compared to how Dog Day Afternoon goes in terms of like negotiating with the FBI guy. They essentially distract the FBI guy, change into costumes to make it look like they're hostages, and they sneak out of the bank with the money taped to them. And so they are very successful. All of them end up getting away, and the FBI guy kind of realizes at the last moment that, oh wait, it was that guy all along. How does that compare to Heat in the job and success of the job in Heat?
Well, Heat has a couple of different jobs of varying degrees of difficulty, but the take is, I would say, is probably bigger in Heat.
Way bigger, way bigger.
Yeah, and I mean, you have an exciting, engaging bank robbery with three characters that you care and know a fair bit about. And yeah, I mean, it's like we said, it's The Blueprint, and it's The Blueprint for a really good reason.
But it's not very successful, right? Like, it ends in a shootout. Ultimately, only one makes it out, but he doesn't even make it out with any of the money, from what I remember, yeah. Or at least very little of the money. So for now, let's just push job. Let's just say that. As you said, you care a lot about the guys who are executing the heist in Heat. For Quick Change, as the heist is going down, you don't know that it's more people beyond just Bill Murray, but then it turns out that there are two inside men inside the bank helping him do this. I would say you get invested with them after they escape. from the bank. And that's where a lot of that character development happens, is as they are trying to get to the airport. So it might be kind of a push for crew as well, just because they're on two separate sides of the coin and when it happens. But okay, say you give the crew to Heat. When you get to film, I would say Heat is a much more memorable film in terms of execution, much more unique in that way, and ultimately more successful.
I mean, Heat made me legitimately ask you if Val Kilmer was a national treasure. Like, the crew is really good in Heat. I haven't seen Quick Change, so I shouldn't be quick to change your mind. But I mean, it's Heat is so good, and Heat is maybe not the most important heist movie, but certainly top two most important heist movies in this bracket, on this list, because of how good it is as a movie, as a character study in some ways, and as a depiction of exciting, exhilarating, and kind, you know, in it, a heist that you're invested in.
So I think it is fair to say that Heat wins that one. I have no qualms about it, but I just wanted to make it clear that it was a pretty good matchup. We are moving on to the last first-round matchup in the quadrant, and that's the 2-seed versus the 7-seed, Hell or High Water versus The Bank Job. Yates, I did not take the time to watch The Bank Job because I saw that it was a Jason Statham movie, and then I saw that it drew Hell or High Water, which is a phenomenal movie, and figured that this would be chalk. Am I correct?
You are correct. However, let me say a few words in defense of The Bank Job.
Okay.
Jason Statham does a surprisingly good job. And those have been my few words in defense of The Bank Job.
Okay. All right. Well, in that case, let's just go ahead and move on to the second round. We'll talk more about Hell or High Water in that matchup.
Yeah, I mean, The Bank Job has a lot of side plots to the point where it just kind of gets muddled. And it is based on a true story, so I get that they're like, oh, well, we need to try and include all these. But the story isn't told super well, and it kind of ends up becoming like an international relations political thriller movie, kind of. Like, I think the second I finished watching it is I texted you and I said, this was the American Hustle of heist movies. Like, it very much has that same vibe. There's a lot of different players trying to get different things, and it ended up being kind of muddled and overly convoluted in a way that took away from the heist. And the heist was, like, not that exciting. They, like, spent the night in the ground underneath the vault, and then they went into the vault and were like, oh, these are nude photos of the Queen of England or the Princess of England or whatever. Yeah, that's basically they come up with incriminating evidence on the British government, I think.
All right, well, it sounds like we've devoted enough time to this. let's go ahead and just put Hell or High Water.
I devoted
through
2 hours to it, damn it. So
you know what, that is fair. All right, so second round matchup of Ocean's 11 versus Ocean's 8. I think this one is pretty clear.
All you need to say is that Ocean's 8 would never have happened if Ocean's 11 hadn't been as good as it was, and Ocean's 8 was not as good as Ocean's 11 was.
Yeah, I mean, the film definitely leans towards Ocean's 11. I would say The Job, The Take is higher in Ocean's 8, but okay, so push on The Job because Ocean's 11 is a high take and the degree of difficulty is about the same. I don't know. I feel like if you're looking at the crew, it's more impressive that Ocean's 11 is able to do it with more people and still get out scot-free. And I think you become a little bit more invested in people in Ocean's 11 than you do in Ocean's 8. But it really comes down to Ocean's 8. I won't go as far to say as it's derivative of Ocean's 11, but kind of in terms of its direction, it's a little derivative
Ocean's 11. It is effectively a reboot of Ocean's 11. I think I think it's perfectly fair to say it's derivative because it is trying to capture the same thing that Ocean's 11 captured with a different cast. And it does a good job of that, but I mean, Ocean's 11, it is Ocean's 11. Ocean's 8 is trying to be like Ocean's 11.
Right. So there you go. Ocean's 11 punches its ticket into the Elite 8. Now into the 2-3 matchup, Heat versus Hell or High Water. Do you want to give us a run-through of Hell or High Water?
All right. So two brothers in Texas are going town to town and robbing different branches of the same bank in order to pay that bank back to prevent the bank from foreclosing on the family farm.
So big revenge aspect in it. A pretty good score here. Pretty good take.
Certainly nothing like what they take in Heat. You know, throughout the movie, they take exactly what they need. Nothing more, nothing less. They need, like, I don't remember how much, like under $15,000. It's not like it's a huge sum of money. It feels like more that when they are stealing, they are kind of trying to take back the right to own their property rather than take the property of others. So it isn't really about the money, and it doesn't feel like it's about the money.
In terms of the crew, it's just Ben Foster and Chris Pine, so everybody's pretty essential.
Okay, honestly, Ben Foster kind of gets in the way more than he helps. I feel like Chris Pine could have done this on his own, if I'm gonna be honest.
Well, listening to this, it sounds like maybe the bank job could have had a real shot here. Maybe I was wrong. Listen.
Why do you say the bank job could have won?
I'm just saying. I mean, well,
you can have a sizable take that's not
in
money, Brighton. Maybe the sizable take is love.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure.
And film. Also, crew. The crew for the bank job, objectively, everyone sucks.
Okay, well, then there you go. But compared to Heat, right? Like, if Ben Foster is not essential and it's just a stick-up, they do a more elaborate stick-up with a bigger take in Heat.
Oh, yeah. No, Heat blows out of the water. It's, yeah. Now, Hell or High Water wins film. Hell or High Water is a better movie. Hell or High Water is one of my favorite movies. I will die on that hill. But in the context of this bracket, and only in the context of this bracket, Heat takes it over Hell or High Water.
Two out of the three categories.
Yes.
So that wraps it up. We'll have an Ocean's 11 versus Heat Elite 8 matchup among some other absolutely heavy-hitting matchups next week as we finish off this bracket. We will be finishing off the bracket coinciding with finishing off the Coen Brothers movies. We've got Ballad of Buster Scruggs on Tuesday for Auteur Theory as we wrap it up.
Coinciding?
Man, you've been on fire today. I feel like we should stop because I'm tired of these puns. But also because this is the end of the episode.
Oh, it is. So, as Brighton said, Ballad of Buster Scruggs on Tuesday. Certainly a weird one. One that I am going to revisit for sure. Until then, follow us on Twitter at RatedPodcast. Like us on Facebook. And as always, check out what we are watching, Coen, Heist, and otherwise, on Letterboxd.